able to observe and examine, from there he should be able to search further and enter that world of the what to us is the unknown, and be able from there to come to an understanding of the spiritual and an understanding of God. That is what he actually says. Now, I want you to understand that there in this, there the that is all that the Derech Hashem says. The Chovos HaLevavos goes into very great detail as far as this is concerned. And he discusses, is it an obligation upon us to search, to observe and to examine the whole of creation, and thereby, after we've done that, to come to an understanding of that which is hidden from us. He discusses, is there an obligation? And it is that with which we were dealing last week. And you remember, he said that there was an obligation, and it was based on three sources. The one source was plainly from the point of view of the intelligence of the human being. The second source was the Torah itself. And the third source was the Torah Shebaal Peh. And what we did last week is we started on the third source. He says it is the normal intelligence of the human being that he is able to, that he understands that he has an obligation to understand nature and everything that he's found about, and to observe it and to examine it. That is an obligation of man. So he says, first of all, it's known by reason, by plain reason you can come to that conclusion. What is the plain reason? And he says something, as I told you, was very interesting. Now, we discussed last week the difference between a human being and an animal. And we found several differences, at least three distinct differences between the human being and an animal. A human being has a body and an animal soul, a biological soul, and at the same time he has a divine soul. An animal has a body and a biological soul, hasn't got a divine soul. And all that goes with the divine soul. Now the difference was, a human being reasons and an animal does things by instinct. A human being is able to laugh, an animal is not able to laugh. Now those are differences which we find between the human being and the animal. The Chovos HaLevavos deals with it differently. He brings forth a fourth difference between a human being and an animal. Now I'm going to ask you a question, and you must answer the question honestly, at least to yourself. Do you ever have a feeling of guilt about making use of something that is in truth very remarkable and not understanding anything about it? You switch on, you come into your apartment, to your home, and you switch on the electric light. You don't have to light a lamp to take matches. You don't, just once upon a time, they have to write about stones together. You're able to come in and to immediately. You go to your stove, your electric stove, you switch it on immediately. You want to hear the news, take the radio. Put on the radio, or... Oh, good. And Pat and Abby, this is Pat and Abby, this is just a brief recap of the first part of last week's show. Now, you go, look at what we have got. You use the telephone. Does anyone amongst you ever feel guilty? You know, I'm reading this, and I absolutely, I don't even know how it works. Anybody ever feels guilty? Anybody ever doesn't feel guilty? Yeah, look at the peace.
It's frustrating. I was trying to envision how things work.
Yeah, but doesn't it worry you? I'm making use of all these things. Does it worry you? No. Does it worry you? You feel grateful that there is something, that means you've got an awareness. Now, I actually worry about it, I just don't understand how these things work. I don't understand how an airplane works. I'm using it every week. I don't understand how it works. I'm using something I don't know anything about yet.
We have an obligation to understand and learn about it. And now, of course, I'm very
busy. Yes, well, so we are speaking about the difference that the Chovas Salavonis makes, the difference between the animal and the human being. Now, he says, a human being is concerned about his surroundings. He's concerned. He asks questions of himself and of nobody else. And a child certainly asks questions. Why does it get dark in the night? What happens? Why is the room sometimes full and sometimes not seen at all and sometimes it's only a slice of it? Why is it like that? Now, my wife is very worried that in the northern hemisphere, the moon is like that. In the southern hemisphere, the moon is like that. You see, how does that come about? Well, an animal isn't worried about that at all. A dog barks at the moon. You think he notices that in the northern hemisphere is like this, in the southern hemisphere is like this. Does he ask any questions? Does he go to another dog and say, have you ever thought about that? You know? He's not interested. It doesn't affect him. That, he says, the Chovas Salavonis, is a difference between a human being and an animal. If that is the case, he says, so if a human being doesn't question it or at all, if a human being doesn't observe and examine, then he's like an animal. That is the point that he makes. Have you got the idea? Abby's sitting far away.
I got the idea.
Yes, but I can't see you.
You got
all right.
Abby. Getting them over humbly.
All right. So that is, he just makes that observation, which is interesting because usually it's an observation that is not done. So he says, therefore, if a person doesn't observe and examine that which goes on in the world and in the universe around him, he says he is like an animal. Now comes an important statement. He says, in fact, he is worse than an animal. Why does he say it's worse than an animal? Because look what the Torah says about it. It says, "Shol yoda shol kerneu, an ox knows its owner, v'chamor eivus ve'olof, and the ass knows its master's crib. Ami lo yoda, my people doesn't know." So it means that a man is worse than an animal. An animal knows its master. Amila, my people, Israel, does not know its master. Doesn't know God. So he says, therefore, a person, a human being, who doesn't observe and examine, he says, it's not that he's like an animal, he's worse than an animal. That is the statement he made. Now, if there's anything you don't understand as I'm going along, please don't hesitate to question me. Do you want to answer me this?
Yes. Yeah.
Mary?
I just wanted to know, what does Chovas Salavonis mean?
Yes, I'll tell you what it means. Abby, last week you asked a question and I didn't have the time to deal with it. So let me now just interrupt the shears for a little while and just tell you something about it. You can sit down now and take it easy. This is easy to understand. You don't have to explain yourself a bit. the table has many areas. It has an area of prose literature. It has an area of poetry. It has the area of law. It has the area of history. There is the area of, when we come down to law, all that I've said before, there is an area of exposition. And that is where what is in the table is explained. But it is explained in such a way, it's an exposition, not a commentary. And there's a big difference between an exposition and a commentary. For example, if you listen to a Beethoven sonata played by Arthur Schnabel, you will say, that is exactly as Beethoven would have played it. And if Beethoven came out of his grave to listen, he would have said, that is exactly right. But if you would have listened to a woman like Dina Bachauer playing that same sonata, Beethoven would have come out of his grave and said, now what is that? Because that is your sonata. Did you know? I would never have played it like that. Which is wonderful. I would never have played it like that. That is already an interpretation. That is not an exposition. Now we have got in the Torah, Rashi is not a commentary. Rashi is an exposition. This is exactly as it is. Sometimes it's difficult to take, difficult to understand. After that we've got commentary. We haven't got expositions anymore. We've got commentary. That is how that person understood it. There's a very big difference between Rashi is an exponent and the others who are commentary. Do you follow the difference there? I've given you the difference in music. Yes, she
is. What is more clever, a person who's an exponent, or a person who's a commentator?
There are two different areas, there are two different schools. I believe that the exponent is the greater person. He can say, this is exactly what it is, and he's able to put it into words. And you've got to be able to put it into very few words. Mm-hmm. So we've got exponents. Rashi is an exponent, Rabbeinu Gershon is an exponent, Rabbeinu Hanano is an exponent, Rabbeinu Nisi Gold is an exponent. We've got a whole school of exposition. Those are exponents. Yes, Tina?
Well, how can we tell the exponent apart from the commentary?
You are going to find it difficult. Yes. You know, when you are trained, you just can't miss it, you see. You give me a passage, it's an exposition, and you give the same on the commentary, I've got no difficulty. This is, it's the reality. In the Gemara, you will find it, I'll just show you the Gemara, it'll be the best thing. This is Rashi. This is Rashi. He is exponent. So look at all this Gemara. The two inner columns are Rashi. He is exponent. This is the Rashbam. He is a commentator. Can you see the difference? This is the Rashbam. Just look at this.
And the comments, the exponent is...
The exponent, there's nothing to say. Yeah. It was the exponent.
You know, by the scriptures, that's how you know.
No.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I can only see with one eye. I had difficulty. Can you explain how you...
Actually, what does he mean with one eye?
You don't know what it's like if you only use one eye. You're not less than... You know, right? You say one more person is
a minion. My uncle once told me. Yeah, this is Rashi, you see. The two inner columns.
These columns.
Yes, these two are Rashi.
So how do we know that's Rashi over when you tell us that the left side
is Rashi? Well, I know that this is Rashi. But I just have to look at it to know that it's not Rashi. Once I see this, I know it's not Rashi.
Yeah,
I wonder whether that
there's
so much of it. Yes, there's so much of it.
The one condensing the other,
you can't say the exact few words. But that is an artist. And after, the last time we had exponents was in the 12th century. After the 10th century, we've never had exponents. We've only got conversations. Rashi probably was the last exponent.
No,
but now you see, this is Rabbeinu Gershom. Rambam is a 25. This is Rabbeinu Gershom. He is an exponent. Can you see?
Yes. Now I see.
Just on that, he's an exponent. Yeah, you see, he has a Rabbeinu Gershom. That's all he is.
Yes.
There he is, you see. Look at the Rashbam.
Yes. Where is he?
This guy's there, yes. Now, just look at it. You see, just look at it.
Yes.
Now, that is the school of, that is the school of the exposition. Rashi, so there's a whole school, it's an area of exposition. After the 12th century, there were no longer any exponents. Then we get commentators, very great commentators, we haven't got any exponents anymore. This is the Sadolans. Yet even Sadolans, we don't ever have that again when the Shia comes to us. But we, that is gone, that period is gone. Period of that is gone. Now, after that is the period of the Rishonim. That is really the first Rishon. After that is the period of the Rishonim. That's a really important period because we can still relate to the Rishonim. And the Rishonim can relate to the earlier ones. So through the Rishonim, we are able to understand the earlier ones. So the Rishonim is a very important. But that is already commentated. But amongst the Rishonim, there is also the school of analysis. And if you take this piece of the world, the inside column is Rashi. The outside column is analysis. The inside column is exposition. The outside column is analysis. Here, the inside column are commentary. The outside column are analysis. Yes? Are you pardon? Sensei. The grandchildren of Rashi. He had tremendous pressure from his grandchildren. And they very often disagreed with him and attacked him. And he loved it. But they very often disagreed with him. One was what they would come, the other was the Reed, the Rashbam. The one with the commentator there is his grandson. So the grandfather, so short, the grandson is a commentator. He's no longer an exponent.
But the analysis?
Analysis is after Rashi. That is, belongs to the period of the Rishonim.
But they are not the same as commentators.
No, they're not commentators. They are analysts. They don't explain the Gemara. They don't explain the Torah. They analyze it. They ask the question from one part to another part. How do the two? Can you reconcile them? What is the difference? Those are the things they discuss. They analyze. You follow? Then you've got the novelist, nothing to do with the novel. The novelist from the word novellum, a new idea. And the novelists are the people who are able to get a principle, they will evolve a principle, and then that is the principle with which they will evolve. They will create a principle out of what they find in the Torah. School of the novelist. Then we've got the school of the codifiers, who took the Gemara and codified. The Rambam is an excellent example of the school of the codifiers. This is the Rambam. He codifies. Are you getting the idea?
Yes.
Now, we've got another school. We've got the school of the lexicographers. The best example of that is Rabbeinu Yosef of Rome. He lived in Rome. He made a dictionary. That was early 11th century. Goes back a long time. He made a dictionary. A dictionary of the Talmud. That is very much more than a dictionary. He explains the word. Then you've got to know that is how he understands that piece of Gemara. and he goes back to me. That's the way he understands it. Now tomorrow afternoon at the learned shiur, that is something that I'm doing. He explains the meaning of a word. And then because he goes to the Gemara and taking it for example, the part that we're going to do tomorrow is where it's discussing a word as the leader. Rashi explains as the leader as being a mansion. Rabbeinu Noson explains that in his dictionary it is a place. Now, I've learned the Gemara according to Rashi. Tomorrow I'm going to learn that Gemara according to Rabbeinu Noson. He learns it because you've got to learn it altogether differently. Because learn the whole thing. Why does he learn it as a cave? He says there's another meaning to the word, it can mean a mansion too. He says, but really the Gemara, yes, it means a cave. Now he's a lexicographer, a different school. So what we have to do is ask that it's tomorrow as a sheer learning. Now Rashi learns it like this. Textbook learns it like this. The analysts, because of questions they've got, learn it like this. So in the analysts we've got two, we've got the Rabbi Nassam and the Reed. So we've got the way Rashi learns it, the way Rabbi Nassam learns it, the way the Reed learns it, the way the Rabbi Nassam learns it. Four different ways of learning it. But that belongs already to the school of the analysts, the novelists, and then you come to the school of the codifiers. From the Gemara doesn't codify. It doesn't tell you what is the law. It's all the discussion on it. Very often, we can work out the law from the Gemara. The way it discusses it all, we can get the idea and work out the law, but not always. The Rambam works out the law all along. And that is the school of codification. Shulchan Aruch belongs to the school of codification. Getting the idea? See how many schools there are. It's mind-boggling. And I want to, if you want to see the Rambam, this is the Rambam, you see. This is the Rambam in the middle. But look what you've got on the side here. Just look what you've got here. Just look what you've got. Just to understand the Rambam. The Rambam doesn't give his sources. He says, this is the law. And the great thing is, how does the Rambam read his conclusion? Reach his conclusion? So we go back to the source. And we try and understand how the Rambam understood that source. Am I making myself clear? You get the idea. So all this belongs to learning. All this belongs to learning. Now, yes?
One part that I know of, he said that Rashi was looking at some, and he was one of the last takes on, because Rashi said that he was one of the first of the Rishonim.
Yes.
So they put him as an intermediary.
He comes right to the end of the Rishonim at the beginning of it. He says, the Rishonim also, the end of the Gaonim. The strength of the Gaonim was exposition. That was the period before the Rishonim. Roughly speaking, the Gaonim were from the year 500 to the year 1000. The Rishonim from the year 1000, act a little bit later, to the year 1500. From the year 1500 to the outbreak of war, the period of the Achrayim.
Outbreak of World War II?
World War II. That was the period of the Achrayim.
Okay.
And before the period of the Gaonim was the period of the Amoraim. Before the period of the Amoraim was the period of the Tanoim. So you go right back, you see. All right, but that is not so important. Now, I've dealt with you with a number of schools already. Now there is another school. Let us call it the school of homiletics. The Midrashim, they explain the Torah in a moralistic way. Sometimes in a poetic way, sometimes in a philosophical way, in a moralistic way. That is the way they explain the Torah. When they give you examples of that. Then we've got also the school of the moralists, and that is the school of Musar. Now the school of Musar goes right back to the time of the Gaonim. They started already in the 8th century. which the school of it existed before, but you make a separate school of it and you create works on it, that started in the 8th century. And that school went right up great until the time of the Mesilas Yesharim and of the Derech Hashem, right up to the year 1700. All this was taking place there, right up to the year 1700. It goes on, since the year 1700 it still goes on. We've got the school of Musa, which is still in existence. Also one of the schools of Torah. The Chovas HaLevavot belongs to the school of Musa, of the Moralists. Now, just let me explain to you something about the Chovas HaLevavot. At this stage, I will tell you that there are many interesting and strange things about the Torah world, and each thing has a meaning. Now, the author of, now when we speak about Shakespeare's work, we call it Shakespeare. When we speak about Dickens, we call it Dickens. Now, in the Torah world, the work is called by, the man is called by his work. So, for example, the Shulchan Aruch is not called Yosef Karo. It is called, he is called Shulchan Aruch. And you find that people, if you say the name of Yosef Karo, say, who is that? And you say, he's the Shulchan Aruch. Oh, yes, we know the Shulchan Aruch. He didn't know that the author was the Yosef Karo. Now, when I was early in my studies, I studied a piece of Avnei Melun. This is the Avnei Melun, and I discussed it with my colleagues, with my friends. This is what the Avnei Melun is. A couple of years later, I'm studying the Ketos HaChoshen. I said, this is funny. This is exactly what the Avnei Melun says. Now, it's impossible that we should have lifted it up out of the Ketos HaChoshen. What happened here? Exactly the same. That they both speak of the same idea, but they use almost the same language. Then I looked at it. Who is the author? I discovered it was the same person. The Avnei Melun and the Ketos HaChoshen were the same person. But we call it the work by Rambam. The Rambam is an exception. We call his work the Rambam. And the reason we call it the Rambam, you know the reason why? He called his work the Yad HaChazokah. What does Yad HaChazokah mean? The strong hand. For what do we use that word Yad? For the Sheikh. He used Yad HaChazokah because the word is divided into 14 books. So Yud Dalet, Yad is 14, that's why I call it Yad HaChazokah. But that is a name we use for the Sheikh. So because of that, nobody calls it Yad HaChazokah. We call it the Rambam. In the beginning, Mishnah Torah, Yad HaChazokah. Mishnah Torah was also considered to be assuming too much. Mishnah Torah means the second Torah. Call it the Yad HaChazokah. Call it just the Rambam. But everything else we call it Bali. Now, the Chovas HaLevavot, I'll tell you the name of the Chovas HaLevavot, but it won't mean anything to you. His name was Rechaya Ibn Pakuda. Rechaya was his first name. Ibn is the Arabic for the son of Pakuda. We know very little about him. He lived in Spain. He lived in the 12th century, in the 1100s. He was born about 1130 and died probably around about 1200. We don't know anything else about him. Now he wrote the work, which is called Chovas HaLevavot. Chovas HaLevavot means the duties of the heart. And in introduction he writes, he says, if you take the Torah, there are duties that belong to the hand. For example, putting on your tefillin belongs to the hand. Separating the challah, the woman separates the challah, it's a mitzvah. When she bakes challah, she separates the challah. She does that with her hand. That is a mitzvah that depends on the hand. Three times a year, One has to go to Jerusalem, to Jerusalem, to use your feet for that. So there are mitzvahs that you do with your feet. There are mitzvahs that you use your tongue and your mouth and your teeth and your sinuses and your lips for prayer, for learning the Torah. For all parts of the body, there are mitzvahs and there are laws. So he writes in his introduction, he says, for your mind, you've got to think. Think of what you say. For everything, he says, there are words that have been written for everything. He says, but there are duties of the heart also, that belong to the heart. He says, nothing has been written on that. Therefore, says the famous Alagovas, I'm not going to call him Bachaya Ibn Pakuda. Nobody calls him Bachaya Ibn Pakuda. Just the famous Alagovas. Just like in California, nobody calls the person Mr. So-and-so, Mrs. So-and-so, Mr. So-and-so. You're a Jean, you're a John. Yeah. We just don't call him Bachaya Ibn Pakuda. Calvin's Salabovitz after his work. Now he takes his work and he divides it into 10 parts. But the interesting thing about it is that even where there are parts where it would appear that it is not a duty of the heart, but it is a duty of the mind, it would appear so. When you go into it and you see how he deals with it, you'll see that he deals with it. I don't want to use the word emotional, because emotional is not a good translation of verges. Tremendous feeling it is with it. So he starts off with the introduction. Introduction is part of it is easy, part of it is 70-75. The first part is Shaar HaYichud, the unity of God. That God is one. Terribly difficult. Don't forget, he lived in the 12th century. He lived in Spain. He wrote his work in Arabic, not in Hebrew. Wrote his work in Arabic. Advised his writers in Arabic. At that time, there was a very strong influence of Arabic philosophy. So he deals with the Arab philosophy, disproving it. Now it is very, very difficult stuff. But he deals with it. Shaar HaYichud in the unity of God, he deals with that. But the interesting thing is, he deals with it, so much feeling goes into it. And perhaps we'll be able to understand that a bit. The next Shaar, he calls Shaar HaBechinah. Shaar HaBechinah means the part of examination. Now the little part that I'm doing with you belongs to that. Examination. It means observing and examining that which goes on. Thus, it is done with so much feeling. It's the heart that really is responding to this. The mind also. But after the mind has grasped this, it's the heart that responds to it. It's a remarkable piece of work. And even this little bit that I'm doing with you, the difference between the animal and the human being, and the human being, therefore, it's in his nature to observe and to examine. And so what is, when he observes and he examines, what does he see? And then he sees, then he describes it all. So much feeling goes into it. That is Shaar HaBechinah. Then he goes on, after Shaar HaBechinah, he goes on Avodas Hashem, service of God. How one serves God, that belongs to the heart. And then he goes on trust in God, faith. That is faith. There was a young man came to me once, who could learn very well, terribly worried and said he was lacking in faith. So I told him to work through this part. Then he speaks about faith. It's a long part and it's not easy. And he works through, there's a tremendous amount from it. And then he goes on, Yichud HaMaaseh, that to be conscious and aware of everything one does, then he speaks about humility. And that is the last. You want to ask anything else?
Yes, it's
yes.
I'm going to speak about it tonight, so it'll come to that.
I just want to say, now that is the famous Alaboka. And this is his work. And it is a verse that, as I say, was written originally in Arabic, but so was the Rambam's Guide to the Perplexed, that was also written originally in Arabic. Many of these words were written. This was translated, possibly still in the lifetime of the famous Alaboka. If not in his lifetime, the generation after this. That was the first time it was translated. Strangely enough, it was translated again by a man who is still alive. He is a Yemenite Jew, and his name is Kapach. And he has manuscripts, old manuscripts. He translated this from a manuscript, the Arabic manuscript that he had, handed down to him from his ancestors. And he's living in Israel. And he also translated, the Rambam wrote a commentary on the Mishnah, but he wrote it in Arabic. It was translated, still in the lifetime of the Rambam, it was translated into English, into Hebrew. He, Kapach, translated it recently into Hebrew. Now he translates it into Hebrew, and he's disrespectful to the first translation. First translation is addition. And he argues with him that wasn't the way to translate it. Now, I found a spot there that I felt that Kapach didn't understand it. And that the original one was correct, and after Kapach missed the point. So I discussed it with a very good job, I unfortunately so long ago, with Moshe Bukashinsky. I discussed it with him, and he looked at it, and he agreed with me. And he said, I'm going to arrange now the new next in Israel that you beat the Kapach, and you discuss it with him. I said, no, under no circumstances, I'm not going to see him. I don't want to see him. He said, why not? I said, I'm afraid of him. First of all, they speak the Hebrew. It'll take me 2 hours to get accustomed to the dialect, because altogether a different dialect, a different pronunciation. So it would take me 2 hours to get it. And his knowledge is, it's just phenomenal, you see. I said, no, I'm not going to meet him. I've never met him. I don't know. But that is the part that's been translated. So when I speak about the Holy Talibovers, this is the verse to be carried there. Right? Now, in this second part, his subject is examination. Examining the world. For example, he will say, the child, the human child, is born absolutely helpless. And horse gives birth to a foe. The foe is not even quite born yet, and he's already standing up. Struggles gets onto his own neck, and he's already standing up. And now he can walk already. He's not even an hour old, he can walk already. A human being, look how long it takes for the baby to walk. Look how long. Now, we observe that, and we must examine it. Why should that be so? Now, in America, you haven't got lions, but you have a very beautiful animal. Unfortunately, there are only 50 of them left in the United States. And that is the mountain lion that is found in Florida. He is a beautiful creature. Now, they have young. Like every animal, the mother cares for the young. And there comes a time when the mother takes the young lion, takes it now into the wild, into the forest, and the lion, young lion stands there, and the mother begins to back away. And the young lion sees it, turns around to come to the mother. And the mother hisses and bears her teeth. He is now in business on his own. The human being that they are. There's always an attachment from the parent to the child. The child grows up, always an attachment. The child gets married, always an attachment. The ultimate, of course, is that the child mustn't realize that the parent is still attached to him, and that he can come back to the parent at any time. He must know that, but he feels it. And when anything goes wrong, he comes back. And when the parent dies, still an attachment. The child is still attached. There's courage. Keeps the yourself. Names his child after the parent. Still attached. Hashem made it so that when the child is born, it's completely happy. What an attachment is formed between the parent and the child. So strong it can never be broken. A parent can never say to a child, now you are on business on your own. Don't dare come back. Don't want to ever see you again. Of course they are. That is why the child is born so helpless. Now he goes through all this. Doesn't say it quite the same way as I say it. I'm incredibly even exposed. Look at the book. Okay, that is what he does in this chapter. Now, this is, before he starts his observations and his examination, what he's speaking about is it obligatory upon us to do that. And he comes to the conclusion that for three reasons. The first reason is just one's own sake. One's own intelligence. Your inner world. Don't you want to know about it? That is a human being. So, and if he doesn't want to know about it, then he's like an animal. Notice it is worse than an animal. An animal knows his owner. An animal as knows his master's crib. And my people, Israel, doesn't know its God, its creator. Doesn't know, just that is the point that he makes here. He says, this belongs to Sarah. Now, I just want to say, then the chemical opponent goes on, and he says, if you want to have proof of it from the polar, he says, I bring proof to you coming from the Torah. For example, it says in the Torah, lift up your eyes on high and see who created all this. So the Torah tells you, lift up your eyes on high and see who created all this. And so he brings various verses like that to prove that it is incumbent upon a person to observe and to discern. And then the third, he goes to fellowship of prayer, he goes to the Gemara, and he finds there you find also the receipt there.
I find a little, that's not the way I really interpret it myself, but it seems to me that I just, this is where I think, well, where does glass come from? And I know the melt sand at some point. How do light bulbs work? And how does the refrigerator work? And how does the sewing machine make these pictures here? You know, how does it get that thread around? I mean, it's two different things. How does it get it to go around?
And how many classes? How do you know? And I've been my whole life so wrapped up in trying to figure out how the world works and how all these things come about. I wouldn't get a thing.
I'll just give you an example. If you just go through the first chapter, is this becoming too much for you?
No.
If you just go through the first chapter, it says, at the beginning, God created light. He said, let there be light. Now, it's not the same light that we have, because it was only in the fourth day that the sun was created. This was another life altogether. When we speak about energy, that is life. And energy is in everything. So when Hashem said Yehi Or, the whole world was filled with that light, pristine light, which was energy. And so in everything there is life. In this piece of paper there is tremendous energy. On this table, tremendous energy. All the atoms are alive and they've got energy. That is the life that we'll be. On the fourth day, when our God created the sun, then there was a withdrawal of life into those places. Wasn't everywhere. Man couldn't exist otherwise. So then there was the withdrawal of that life. So the energy remained, but there was a different type of life, and that was the different life that was on the fourth day. So then we go, that's on the first day. On the second day, makes the heavens. Make the waters. Let the waters divide between heaven and earth. So there's water and there's land. Also as was created. First of all, there was no such thing as liquid and no such thing as solid. It's all mixed together. Not liquid and not solid. And then God said, let the waters collect to one place. So the waters were there, so there was solid and there was liquid. So there was the ocean, with only one ocean here. Then Hashem said, once he wanted seas, so the ocean had to become seas. So the ocean went into the land and formed the Mediterranean, and from the Mediterranean went into the land and formed the Adriatic, and then it went into the land and formed the Black Sea. And then we go up and it went into the land and it formed the Baltic, and from the Baltic it went further and formed the Gulf of Finland, and so God, you're the geography specialist, and so it's all, that is what happened. All that is the creation of the inorganic, and then starts the creation of the organic. And you remember how it says in the Torah, and God said that everything that Shehu Oris worship. Let the earth bring forth Geshev. Now, Geshev is vegetation, but it is the lowest form of vegetation. Fern belongs to Geshev. Mosses, algae, fungi, lichens, that is Geshev. First thing that was created. No stamens, no pistils. So how does the fern reproduce? Spores at the back of the nucleus, spores. So both have stamens and no pistils. The lowest form of plant life. Then Hashem says, Eisev Mazria Zera. Now, producing seed produces a flower, flowering from the stamen, pistils. The pollen is on the stamen. The pollen, the stamen fertilizes the piston either through bees or through the wind, whatever it may be. Then you've got a higher form of life, of plant life. Then you've got the eighth tree, also tree. Then you've got a fruit tree producing fruit. Our shears are over. and the seed is in the fruit. Highest form. Three forms of life. Just examine that. Just observe it and examine it. Because people like Rio Grande speaking about animals. H3OC3 speaking about perennials. Now it's all developed. Now for the person, when you learn the Chumash, to be aware of all that, that is what it is telling us. So that is what he asks us to do. That is what the Baruch Hashem asks us to do. Now the Rambam comes along, and he's also got something to say about it. He says, in the Torah it says, "Ve'ohavta et Hashem Elokecha," you shall love the Lord your God. And he says, well, how does one achieve that? How is it possible to love God? I haven't got it in there. I don't feel like that. So you see, the very interesting thing is this. The Heichia Doris Re Abo says, what is the way in which one can love God? So he says, the Shehoshi is building the order of the Master with the Ruavan is Loima de Doni. When a man contemplates the works of the Creator and his wonderful and great creation, and the Yiri Mayhem Chokhmo Sosha Engel Eilich Melokates, and he sees the wisdom of it all, that one cannot evaluate and there is no end to it, the Yad who Ohev, for the Shabbat immediately, he says he must love and praise and glorify God. Overcome by the greatness, the majesty of it all, the beauty of it all. Overcome by that. And that is his creator. And why has God created it? Has to be observed. What is the reason for it all? Why is it? All this, everything is there in the field. Why is it? When you observe and you examine, you come to the realization of that which isn't so clear. And that is all for one purpose. For man. That man should have it all. He should have that enjoyment, that pleasure. Man should have it all. Coming to a conclusion, coming to the wisdom of God. Now, I'm afraid we'll have to end it there. Abby, I'm fully aware of your question, which is a very good question. We'll carry on from there the next time. All right? But are you giving a better idea of the whole I can't hear. Yes, anyway, now you know. If you know what it is who you want, as much as we know very little about it, we want you to know. And we also know to what field you can sit in, and this room fits into a steam, it's a long steam, and it's this part of it becomes a very important part. Now, I have a cousin whom I know was working on making a shortened form of it. And he told me about it, that he was working on it. And when he died, they couldn't find the name. And they got hold of me and said, did he ever tell me where he's got and what he's got? Couldn't find the name. And it was supposed to be a name of it, but he really understood that that was some good. And there's a suspicion that somebody stole it. Knew what the value of it was, stolen, and the one they printed. You know that. We can't find, we know that he was working on the compound of manuscript. Yes, you know.
So, yesterday, he says, I've been told that one is not, one can never think that was a term to observe their beautiful creation. But because one is a lower level, just watching nature and appreciating the shampoo very tired decision.
I'm thinking wonder about it. I speak to you wonder about it. That's correct. Now, it was useful also to Lord Shiva that she's really got the place to do this. See that? There's a few screws out of that. I'm responsible for that. The failure that I'm responsible for that. That is what it is. But the outcome is a point that has been raised at the table, it was raised up to ever last week, been raised before, and that is that they are great scientists and they are arch disbelievers. They are atheists. So how does this clear? How is it possible? That we will discuss today. The ability of the question. How is it that we will discuss?
That's
right. So they can get a tremendous appreciation, and they've got a deed to it, to know that there is God. That is the way they get it. All right. Thank you, lady. Please don't keep your husband waiting tonight.
No, just quickly. We mentioned on this one that we're to do the last week. And if anybody do have a checkbook with them last week, the Bible is still $15, many, many years already, $15, anybody wants to join, I'll take the check tonight. I'll take the check tonight, good Mrs. Rosanna.
We were over here, you know,
okay.
Were you looking at the photographs?
Oh, thank you. Oh, okay. Thank you, Jenny. Thank you, Jenny.
Roger, okay.